for great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts. The TNT Shop is now open at tntradio.live. Bruce DeTorres. Bruce DeTorres. On today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
This is World Stage with Bruce DeTorres, exposing the tyrannies and exploring our power with deep dives into history, current events, dangerous trends, and the nature of reality. And I discovered TNT Radio last year, actually, honestly. Someone at TNT discovered me. I'm the author of a book called God's School, 9/11 and JFK, The Lies That Are Killing Us and the Truth That Sets Us Free. And I had the privilege of being invited to be a guest on one of TNT's shows. And then another show and another show and another show. And after five or six appearances, I reached out and said, boy, I'd sure love my own show, because a station like TNT is an oasis, a flare in the night, a blade of grass breaking through the pavement in allowing the truth to be pursued and to have people come on and teach and share what they know, that the monolithic mainstream, at least in America, doesn't want us to know so much of reality, of things that really, really are important. And we're going to have one of those conversations right now, because joining me is Dr. Patrick Moore, who has a PhD in ecology and has been a leader in the international environmental field for over 30 years. He is a founding member of Greenpeace and served for 9 years as president of Greenpeace Canada and 7 years as a director of Greenpeace International. He is the author of Confessions of a Greenpeace Dropout, The Making of a Sensible Environmentalist, about which and in which he explains why, after 15 years after co-founding Greenpeace, he left to establish a more sensible, science-based approach to environmentalism. From energy independence to climate change, genetic engineering to aquaculture, he sheds new light on some of the most controversial subjects in the news today. Patrick is also a director with the CO2 Coalition, co2coalition.org, the nation's leading organization providing facts, resources, and information about the vital role carbon dioxide plays in our environment, co2coalition.org. He also wrote The Positive Role of Human Emissions of CO2, a discussion about the role of atmospheric CO2 in the maintenance of life on Earth and the positive role of human civilization in preventing CO2 from trending downward to levels that threaten the very existence of life. That PDF, The Positive Role of Human Emissions of CO2, can be found on his website, ecosense.me, ecosense.me. He also wrote the book, Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom. His description, his unique thesis is, it dawned on me one day, well, that's rather lengthy. I'm going to let Patrick describe that, because this introduction has been robust enough. It's an honor to welcome you here, Patrick. How are you today?
I'm very well, Bruce, and thanks for such a nice introduction. only one point. Yeah, it says 30 years there. It's actually 50 years since I started help start Greenpeace back in 1971. I guess that's even a couple of years more than that. So I think that's an old, just a, means it's an old bio. But I've been at this for a long time, and I have made a study of the ecology of the Earth and its relationship to the rest of the universe, including the sun and the planets. And I've come to the conclusion that these climate change catastrophe people have basically created a new religion, which is a religion that is evil because it's meant to strike fear into people. It's almost as if the devil has got hold of the political philosophy in this world today. And I'm not a religious person, actually. I have a great deal of reverence for the earth and life, and I don't think I have an evil bone in my body, and I can honestly say I've never told a lie in my life. but at least not the one that I knew was one. And when I find out that it was, I would change it to the truth. And the thing is I learned the word ecology when a professor of ecology from Czechoslovakia who had escaped communism after the Second War was adopted by the University of British Columbia. And he came to a noon-hour lecture when I was in first-year forestry. I eventually branched out into ecology from there. And that was the first time I heard the word ecology. It hadn't been used in the public press or in any public information at that point. Environment was being talked about in the late 60s, but the word ecology had yet to emerge as a word known to people in general. It was a very obscure word. And ecology means basically trying to understand the interrelationships amongst all of the millions of species, of rock types, of waters and air and the sun and the gravitational effect of Jupiter, which affects the tide and the cycles of climate on the Earth to a considerable extent. And it gives you a feeling of wholeness and wellness to understand these things in conceptual terms. And that's what this second book of mine, well, actually I had an earlier book titled Trees Are the Answer, which didn't go in digital. So, but it's still available as a used book on the internet. And I'm thinking of redoing it as a digital book. But Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom has a common thread about many different scare stories. And that is that virtually all of them, if not all of them, are based on things that are either invisible, like CO2, radiation, and the fake thing in GMOs that people think is bad, which actually doesn't even exist. If it did, it would have a name. So it's not only invisible, but doesn't exist, whereas CO2 and radiation do exist. It's just that nobody can observe them for themselves. Nobody can see what they're doing. So it's easy to make up a story about them. And if you want to scare people into voting for you or want to scare people into buying something, you can do that by using an invisible subject that they can't look at for themselves. And the second category is things that are very remote, which might as well be invisible, such as the polar bears, the walruses, and the coral reefs. And that's why those three species are often used to scare people into thinking the world is coming to an end, or all the ice will melt on the Arctic, or the coral reefs are dying, all of which are lies. And so that's what the book is about. And it shows you in so many different categories. Let's just start with one that doesn't have to do with climate change. And that is the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, twice the size of Texas, of plastic waste in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. It does not exist. It is fake. There is no Pacific Garbage Patch. If you go on the internet and look at Pacific Garbage Patch images, all of them are fake images, except for one. And that is an image which does show a massive bed, sea full of garbage, some of which is obviously plastic. But I looked at it for a bit and I thought, there's mountains in the background of this picture. It says underneath it, a piece of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, as a caption. I realized that someone else had figured this out too. It's the debris that was washed off the cities of Japan from the tidal wave, from the tsunami. And I think it's heretical to take those 20,000 people who died in that tsunami and say it's the Pacific Garbage Patch. But then if you look in my book, you'll see I have an actual satellite photograph from a German satellite, which is a composite of the entire Pacific Ocean, showing every piece of it without clouds, because each day some are cloudy, but they put them all together after a year's worth of taking photos. And you can see the Hawaiian Islands quite clearly, not just the big island, but the trailing off little islands. You can see them. They are not twice the size of Texas. There's nothing there. Absolutely nothing. And so, but when people come up to me after I speak on this subject, they say, well, I think it's just the clear plastic. That's why you can't see it. Oh, sorry, but the clear plastic actually sinks. So it's not the clear plastic. And then they say, oh, it's just under the surface, as if each piece of plastic has its own buoyancy compensation device. And then they come back to this. It's microplastic. Oh, it's invisible. really, that's convenient. And at the same time, they're saying it takes 2,000 years for plastic to break down. It never breaks down. Well, how did there get to be microplastic then? So it's a completely hollow, empty lie that there is a Pacific garbage patch. And yet they get away with all these TV specials about collecting all the plastic in the ocean and everything as if their saviors come from heaven. When in fact, yes, there is plastic in the ocean, and it has two positive features. One, it's no different than driftwood in terms of it's a floating reef where marine organisms that attach themselves to things, that's called sessile, like barnacles, use them as a home. And then other species come and eat the species that are using the plastic or wood debris that goes in the ocean as a home. And so that's one reason why they're not. And of course, the idea that that plastic suddenly becomes toxic when it goes in the ocean. I mean, we wrap all our food in it and contain much of our food in plastic. Not because it's toxic, because we want to prevent our food from becoming contaminated. The plastic is a barrier, a non-toxic barrier, which keeps our food fresh and uncontaminated. So that's the first thing about plastic, is it's not toxic and it's not hurting the oceans. Some people think litter is ugly, like beer cans and throwing on the side of the road. You know, I understand that. It's an aesthetic issue, though. It's not a pollution issue. And well, then comes, yeah. then comes, oh, along with that, in some ways, plastic is better than wood because it sinks as a bottle or a cup, and organisms use it as a shelter, as housing. So Greenpeace has a picture of a crab inside a clear plastic cup, and the caption is, the crab is trapped in the cup. Well, it's got an opening. It's got an opening on it, much larger than the crab. It's a cup shape. So obviously, the crab could get out if it wanted to. It's using it for shelter. It's using it for habitat. So the second thing about plastic in the ocean, for at least 50 years now, since plastic has been some of it's been ending up in the ocean, going down rivers mostly. Seabirds, of which there are tens of millions, especially big ones like albatross too, they now use the hard bits of properly sized and shaped plastic as a digestive aid in their gizzards and in their chicks' gizzards before their chicks can fledge. They actually go and collect a collection of plastic bits and wood bits and nuts, which are the right shape. And if a squid is fed to the chick, the beak of the chick is retained in the gizzard to help grind the food. Anything hard and sort of round and not too big makes a very good digestive aid. Land birds use pebbles, but there's no pebbles in the sea. So the seabirds have a harder time finding appropriate objects to use as digestive aids in the gizzard, but plastic has now become one of them and therefore is beneficial to all these seabirds. That's just one of the chapters in my book.
And one of the riveting points, because as I was reading the positive impact of human CO2 emissions on the survival of life on Earth, you make the point, as you basically were describing, you've got a PhD in ecology. Ecology is a science, and we've been at the mercy of so-called self-styled environmentalists. And I think you make the point, environmentalism isn't a science. And your message and your teaching, which we're going to get into on the other side of a break in a couple of minutes, is vitally important, because it's been a pleasure to study you for the last, you know, number of days preparatory for this conversation, Patrick, because my head is spun just as much as anybody else's listening to the bombardment of the climate change story given by the mainstream, which really is a horrifying doom and gloom manipulation that governments, et cetera, and agencies are really, really riding herd on, to persuade us and twist our arms and just have us, you know, go crazy, but also get into lockstep toward many, many things that I feel are very, very detrimental economically and just in a life-sustaining way in the long run. We are going to go to that break right now. My guest is Dr. Patrick Moore, a founder of Greenpeace and the author of books such as Confessions of a Greenpeace Dropout, The Making of a Sensible Environmentalist. And he will be with us on the other side of this little break here on TNT Radio.
TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
You know, on this show, we talk often about what's going on in the world when it comes to trans and sports and women in sports and how they're getting really screwed, and where all the women's rights groups and activists and who have been fighting for, you know, equal pay for women and women's rights and sports and equality and all that. Where have they gone? One recent example of all this, a Christian school in Vermont, girls basketball team. They were in the playoffs, and I think it was game four. This is late last month, near the end of the month. They dropped out. They forfeited the game. They dropped out of the, they lost their place in the tournament because the other team has a biological male. You know, basketball is a physical sport. I'm not sure why it took them four games to realize this, but nonetheless, they dropped out. And this kind of thing is happening. It's happening to girls, and it's all part of the plan. It all fits in, you know, groom the kids from a young age and then make them accept anybody and anything in any bathroom, no sexes, whatever. It's really, really scary.
Steve Malzberg on TNT Radio.
When a crisis hits close to home and across the globe, nonprofits are on the front lines, ready to serve.
Keep coming.
The demand for charitable services has skyrocketed, and nonprofits are rising to meet the needs. Healing. Nurturing. Rescuing. Honoring. Protecting. Caring. Inspiring. The work of philanthropic organizations of all sizes, across all missions, has never been more important. And it's donors and volunteers like you who make all this possible. Thank you. Together, we change the world. The Nonprofit Alliance.
Turn on Alexa and ask her to play
TNT Radio.
Turning on anything else usually requires dinner and conversation, dressing up and brushing your teeth, and I'm already tired.
This is today's news talk
and the voice of freedom,
TNT Radio.
This is World Stage with Bruce DeTauris, exploring the tyrannies and, exposing the tyrannies and exploring our power. And my guest is Dr. Patrick Moore, founding member of Greenpeace, and a director with the CO2 Coalition, which can be found at co2coalition.org, the nation's leading organization providing facts, resources, and information about the vital role carbon dioxide plays in our environment. And Patrick, I definitely want you, sooner than later, maybe now, to, if you wouldn't mind, tell us the orthodoxy of the CO2 horror story per the mainstream that most people are being bombarded with, and then teach us, if you will, the reality of what CO2 is, and also the big picture context of what affects temperature on the planet and where human-generated CO2 plays a role in that.
Yes, Bruce, it's amazing that there are four key points here and maybe a fifth one. The first key point is that the Earth is colder now than the last 250 million years. We are in a new ice age that started 2.6 million years ago. That's why the poles are just covered in miles of ice. And especially during the glacial advances. We're lucky enough to be in an interglacial period now, but there have been 45 glacial advances during the Pleistocene Ice Age at different intervals, starting with 40,000 intervals and now at 100,000 year intervals. No one really knows why it jumped, but it's got to do with the Milankovitch cycles. You'll have to look that up because it takes too long to explain it. But The last ice age, the Karoo, ended 250 million years ago. And since then until now, there was no ice anywhere on the Earth, and that is a period of total flourishing of life. life was from pole to pole. The Antarctic was forested, and so were the Arctic islands of Canada. And giant camels were roaming in them up until 5 million years ago, when it started to get really cold. And since 2.5 million years ago, it's been freezing on this planet, pole to pole almost. I mean, the tropics have stayed about like they are through all of this. When the Earth warms and cools, it does so more towards the poles. Actually, at the equator, it hardly changes at all. But the further you go towards the north or south pole, the warmer it gets, and then the cooler it gets through these cycles. So that's the first point. The second point is CO2 is lower now, even with our increase in it up from 280 to 400, than it has been through more than 90% of the history of life on Earth, which is 3 billion years. CO2 has, on average, consistently gone down. It's never gone in a big upward. This little tick that we've added to it now, you can hardly see it on a graph compared to where it was before. Because before it was at 10,000 parts per million when life emerged from the sea. And then 6,000, then 4,000, then 2,000, then 1,000. And at the height of the last most recent glaciation 20,000 years ago, it went down to 180, which is only 50 ppm parts per million above the death of plants. The next factor is that we have absolutely no proof that carbon dioxide is the cause of climate in this world, of temperature in this world. If you look at the graphs, you see that temperature goes up and down, up and down, up and down, with no actual trend in terms of going generally up or down, whereas CO2 has just generally gone down. They are not in correlation with each other sufficiently to imply causation. Correlation does not imply causation by itself. The classical case is ice cream consumption and shark attacks. They are highly correlated. Each year, they go up and down in exactly the same curve. But that's because a third factor, which is temperature, is the real cause of both of them. Because in the summer, you go to the beach, have an ice cream cone and go swimming and maybe get attacked by a shark. In the winter, neither of those things happen. So that's the third one. The fourth one, and perhaps the most important for everybody to realize, the fourth one is that CO2 is entirely beneficial for life on Earth, even at much higher levels than it's at now. It is absolutely essential for life. It is carbon-based life that we have on this planet, and all the carbon came from CO2 in the oceans and the air. The oceans contain nearly 50 times as much carbon dioxide as the atmosphere does, partly because the atmospheric CO2 has gone down so low over time. But that's the fact. It is a fact that all of the CO2 in life, all the carbon in life came from CO2. And we don't know of any negative thing about it. They're blaming the slight changes in temperature that are occurring in the Earth now, which have no... They say 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees is going to be a problem. That's less than the difference between Washington, D.C. and New York in terms of annual temperature graphs. It's just ridiculous. 2 degrees Celsius higher temperature in this world would not kill anything. There may be a bit of migration. Mostly, if it gets warmer, the ice will retreat and green plants will replace where they were, which is not a bad thing. Ice is the enemy of life, in fact. How many things do you see growing on ice? And surely life is more important than ice. And it's the same thing they have now with the whales and the wind turbines. Off New York, they're going to build 1,500 wind turbines where there's 5,000 whales feeding every summer. Greenpeace is on the side of the machines instead of the whales. They have betrayed their own founders, including me, because I spent 4 years on the Pacific Ocean in a boat, getting in front of harpoons in a little boat against the Russian and Japanese whalers, and we stopped the slaughter of 30,000 whales every year out there, which was still going on in the 70s. So, and now Greenpeace is on the side of the wind turbines against the whales. Whale deaths have increased by 400% since they started this program of doing sonar. There's more ships there now. There's noise in the ocean. Whales are an acoustic species. And so the fifth point is perhaps the most interesting, and that is that every single molecule of CO2 we are emitting into the atmosphere came from the atmosphere in the first place. Where do they think it came from? Mars?
Hmm.
CO2 was absorbed. This is the reason why it's been going down steady, because it was absorbed in two ways. First, into making the fossil fuels. The fossil fuels are of life origin. They were created by living things. The coal was created by forests, and the gas and oil was created by marine sediments that were the organic parts of species that animals that died went to the bottom and turned into oil and gas over millions of years. So, but that's only a small portion of the carbon that was removed from the atmosphere in the oceans. Calcium carbonate, otherwise known as limestone, and chalk and marble and dolomite, which are all stones, are made from life too. They didn't come out of a volcano. All the limestone on this earth was created by shelled creatures in the sea. The coral reefs, the clams, the oysters, the barnacles, the crabs, the shrimp, you name it. All those creatures that learned to make armor plating for themselves out of calcium carbonate, which is what limestone is. It was a very smart thing to do, to make an armor plating for your soft body so you could protect yourself from predation. Imagine a clam without a shell, how easy it would be for something to eat that. And so it was really intelligent. But inadvertently, by doing this, they presaged the end of life through the total loss of carbon in the atmosphere and the oceans to a level that would not support life anymore. It would just peter out with a whimper. In other words, the earth life would not go out with a bang, but with a whimper. And we are the only species that are capable of putting it back. And we did that inadvertently. We didn't mean to increase the CO2 in the atmosphere when we started using fossil fuels. We did it for energy. And so this is a point people have to understand. This, that CO2 was in the atmosphere before, and it got reduced by the creation of these sediments, which are no longer available to species because they're in a solid form underground, whereas the only carbon dioxide that's available is dissolved in the ocean and in the air, in the fluid portions of the Earth's environment, where they can get at it, and they can't get at it in the ground. And so we're taking it out and putting it back and making the Earth greener again as a result. And go and look at Greening of the Earth, NASA. And you will see that even NASA, a U.S. government agency, is recognizing the fact that additional CO2 is causing the Earth to green. And then these greeny idiots make up stories about how, well, it'll be bad to have more CO2, so we shouldn't be doing that, when in fact it's causing more growth of plants, and the Sahara, Southern Sahara, is starting to green up, and trees are moving out into the grasslands in Nevada and California where it was too dry for them before, because more CO2 also has a second effect besides increasing the growth of plants. It makes them more efficient with water. And so they can live in places where there wasn't enough water for them before, as more CO2 accumulates in the atmosphere. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. And all of that is true science.
Amen. And I saw where you stated that the extra CO2 that humans seem to have produced in our industrial phase lately seems to maybe be offsetting the natural decline and therefore benefiting us. Did I capture that right?
Correct. If we hadn't come along, or some other species that could have figured out how to use fossil fuels and make cement, because cement is made from calcium carbonate, so part of our CO2 emissions are from those stones that were created by the shelled creatures in the sea over 500 million years. And yes, we have reversed that trend. And as I say, if we hadn't reversed it, it would have kept going down until life petered out. And that would have been in 1 million, 2 million, 3 million years. And we've come along in terms of geologic time, which life started through 3.5 billion years ago, at least. In that kind of time scale, we were damn near the end of life on this Earth. If something hadn't happened to reverse that trend in CO2 emissions, in CO2 decline. You can see all of this stuff is easy to find, but if you want to find it in a very small book of 208 pages, it's in my book, fake invisible catastrophes and threats of doom. The largest chapter in it, of course, is the one on climate change. But let me make one other point, unless you're going to a break within the next minute.
That point
is that the climate change side of things is a big budget. There's a lot of billions going into the climate change research, so-called. 80% of all the research in science now is in universities, and most of it is being paid for by the public purse. So politicians are using their bureaucrats to give money to so-called scientists in the universities, who then make their living spreading this thing about the earth dying. And that's what's going on. But that's the quiet part. The noisy part is the politicians using those papers to say, look, the scientists have said, and the media and the activists making money, Greenpeace is making money hand over fist with this. And what are they actually doing to save the earth? Nothing. They say they're doing something to save the earth by saying the earth is going to die. You know, and they're saying we can save the earth by cutting all our fertilizer and cutting all our fossil fuels, which is a death wish if there ever was one. Right. Right now, today, we're at a cusp right now. The collapse of these banks in Silicon Valley. Now in Switzerland, there's a really big problem going on with the banking there. All these big funds, which have decided not to bother worrying about whether they make money anymore and are doing good for social and economic reasons, the environmental social governance model, ESG, the World Economic Forum, all the billionaires who don't care if half the other people die because they won't be among them because they'll be able to stay alive. So we've got a situation where this is going to be a self-created doomsday. It's not the climate. Right. It's the woke politicians and the billionaires.
Would you teach a little more about that right now, about how if the levels of reduced fossil fuel were reached, it's a suicide mission?
Yes. Well, 82% to 85% of our energy is from fossil fuels to begin with. They are saying we should replace it with wind and solar. Just the batteries to back up wind and solar, which is only available between 10 and 30% of the time. So the rest of the time, you have to use the battery storage. Batteries don't make energy. They just store it, and then you can take it out when you want it. But think of this. If there's a city with industry, when the wind and solar is working, it has to supply most of the energy for that city. But it also has to charge the batteries while it's doing that, because you can't charge the batteries when the wind and solar isn't working. You can only charge the batteries when the wind and solar is working. So it turns out that in the United States, the cost of the batteries alone would be about the same as the entire gross domestic product of the United States. In other words, all the money would have to go to making batteries. That doesn't count the cost of the wind and solar infrastructure, and it doesn't count the cost of actually living. So this is why this model of net zero, the reason it's not going to happen is because it's impossible. But if we try to make it happen, we could go halfway towards impossible and find ourselves in a situation where a vast number of people would starve to death and wars would break out, and we would go into total chaos. And that is a distinct possibility unless people wake up really soon right now.
Yes, I've heard you describe it specifically to, there's no way to replace the fossil fuel that they want to eliminate in X number of years to a sufficient extent where one could supply the food production and the delivery of food just into the cities and along those lines that you were just describing.
And, yes, that's right.
And have you seen in the last couple decades, and we are going to go to a break in about 2 minutes, but we'll start to talk about this, Patrick, as you described how Greenpeace is just, it's a flip-flop of what it was intended to be or what it claims to be. Do you see that in the immediate realms around so-called protecting the environment? I hope that was a grabbable question. Did you comprehend did that make sense to you?
I certainly did. They're all of those groups which are saying that climate change is an emergency, a crisis, and all of these things, they are off the rails. Climate change is not an emergency. there are weather events which become emergencies. That's been happening forever. There's been a 92% reduction in deaths from weather in the last 100 years on a per capita basis. That's because we protect ourselves. We have weather reports. We know what's coming. We have better houses and all those things. We have done a very good job in the developed world. Now, when it comes to the Philippines and many of the underdeveloped countries, they're still, let me give you an example. When the tsunami hit Japan. Yes.
Patrick, please, that example on the other side of this little break that we have to take. I've got the honor of speaking with Dr. Patrick Moore here on TNT Radio.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
It really is getting hard to believe the stuff that comes out today. I'm not going to even call it disinformation. I'll call it half information. The Washington Post, you know, it used to be a great paper. It really did. I mean, I had a friend that worked for the Washington Post back in the 80s, and we would talk about their editorial board and how they always try to present the other side. But once again, the Washington Post is at it. They say the reason your allergies are getting worse in the United States is because of climate change, because springs are coming earlier. That is total unmitigated nonsense. All right. The last 15 years, there's been no significant change in U.S. March and April temperatures. In addition, it's amazing. We had a warm February in the United States. Guess what? The 5-day period running up to the first day of spring, one of the coldest on records, especially in the deep south. They don't even bother looking. It's the same story over and over and over again. Well, guess what? Maybe there are other reasons why allergies are worse, like what you're eating, what you're drinking, your general health. But no, it's got to be blamed on climate change. This is TNT Climate and Weather Watchdog meteorologist Joe Bastardi asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you got.
How was your drive to school?
Let me tell you. I had to get my iced coffee first. I just can't seem to put it down. My favorite rapper just announced a tour. My phone was buzzing like crazy. I'm so excited. I had to text all my friends right then to talk about it. Then someone started calling me and...
Let's try that again.
I turned my phone off right away. I never drive distracted.
Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
This is World Stage with Bruce DeTorres on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
And with us is Dr. Patrick Moore, founding member of Greenpeace, the author of Confessions of a Greenpeace Dropout, The Making of a Sensible Environmentalist, and also the book Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom, available at Amazon. You were contrasting against the... developed nations, Patrick, the Philippines as an example of the underdeveloped and what's happening there.
Well, I'll use a different example. It's a really good comparison. The tsunami that hit Japan from this 9-point-something earthquake, it killed 20,000 people, but it was all from the tsunami. The earthquake itself didn't kill anybody because Japanese know how to build buildings that are able to withstand very, very powerful earthquakes. Not long after, a couple of years after, a tsunami, an earthquake in Haiti of 20 times less strength than the one that hit Japan killed 250,000 people, mostly roofs made from substandard concrete falling on their heads. So it just goes to show you that we can make ourselves much more resilient by using good technology, and that means creating wealth that's capable of producing that good technology. Wealth is the key to living longer and surviving on this planet. And we can make ourselves wealthier, except these people want us to make ourselves all impoverished and half of us die. They want us to stop using nitrogen fertilizer, which is made from natural gas and nitrogen in the atmosphere, combining them in the Haber-Bosch process, which got two Nobel Prizes when it was invented. And it's why there's 8 billion people on the earth today, because our agricultural productivity went up so much because of using fertilizer on crops. They want that ended. And they're basically saying straight out that they want 50% of the people on this planet to die.
Right. There's no other way to conclusion. Is that effort to eliminate that fertilizer underway being implemented in various countries already?
Yes, it is. It's being implemented in Sri Lanka, where the president and the finance minister had to escape in a boat in order to not be murdered by the mob for doing this. And Netherlands says it's going to shut down 3,000 farms in order to reduce the use of nitrogen. Netherlands exports more food into other countries of Europe than any other country in Europe does, because they have so much of that beautiful, fertile delta land that was made by the Rhine River and other rivers. And they've learned how to dike off areas that were underwater before and grow food below sea level. 25% of the Netherlands is below sea level. When people tell me they're worried about sea level rise, I tell you two things. First, you won't have to run. It's rising at 2 millimeters a year. Second, hire the Dutch, because they know how to handle that sort of thing.
And you've said plenty to give me the impression that you might be persuaded, as I am, that there are so many life-threatening official policies being put into place over the last many years. It's pretty persuasive that there seems to be an intent to do exactly that, eradicate a large portion of the world's population. Is that fair enough?
Yes, fair enough, Bruce. There's no way. Maybe they don't understand that. I can't see how they wouldn't. How can you cut food supply and energy supply, cut food supply by 50%, cut energy supply by 80%, and not think it's going to cause the collapse of human civilization on this planet? That's why we're able to be here. You need energy. You know, I have a very short way of saying it, is that without energy, there would be no motion. Motion requires energy, any kind of motion. And without motion, there would be no time. That's just a philosophical point. Some people say, I've argued this on Twitter, some people say, yes, there'd still be time if nothing moved. I don't see how you would measure it, though, if nothing moved. So this is what they're trying to do, is they are trying to stop us from moving. Because we can't move without energy. And we can't eat without food.
Many have observed without motion, there is no life. In fact, motion might be the first indicator of life. So, and then, as you also alluded to, the precariousness of the banking situations, it seems to me to be something of a full spectrum assault on a large portion of humanity.
It's impossible not to accept that as fact if you're a rational person. The thing that puts the lie to their whole deal is nuclear energy could replace 50, 60, 70% of the fossil fuels. And I would be in favor of that, because they're precious. And for some things, they're almost indispensable, such as flying an airplane. They're not indispensable for heating buildings, but if they want to get rid of the fossil fuels, all you have to do is replace it with nuclear energy. There's 100 nuclear energy plants operating in North America, more than that, in fact, and not one human being has been injured by them from radiation, not one. Mm-hmm. And you can't say that about the fossil fuel industry or the wind energy or the solar energy. Is when nuclear is the safest in terms of deaths caused or injuries caused per amount of power produced. Why are they against nuclear energy? Russia, India, and China are going full bore ahead on them, in the same way that Russia and India are going full bore ahead on coal, and so is South Asia. And so are, and now Europe is turning back to coal because they've been cut off from Russian gas. So it looks like net zero and the end of fossil fuels will hopefully be discarded sooner rather than later, because it's already having a serious effect on things. And the billionaires, it doesn't affect them if they lose half their wealth. But people who are making 40,000, 50,000, 60,000 a year, if you take half their money away, they can't afford to feed their children anymore. And there's more of them than there is billionaires, way more of them.
Living paycheck to paycheck. Yeah.
You know, I'd love to come back on a couple more shows with you, Bruce, to go through some of the other issues I've got in my book, because I think people would be interested in many of them. The genetic modification story, the story of polar bears, the story of coral reefs, and each one of those takes a segment to deliver properly. And you know, I don't believe in sloganeering or just saying, well, everything's fine. You know, I really like to give people the real information about these issues.
And you have to leave us in a minute. Is that true?
It is true. I'm sorry, because we had an earlier date that now has been encroached on by half an hour, and I've really got to go because it involves my wife. Yes.
I'm very grateful. And watch for emails from me inviting you back ASAP. We'll coordinate that ASAP. Patrick, this was a real pleasure, and enjoy the rest of your evening.
You too, Bruce. And I really like coming on. Don't ever worry about bothering me. I'm fairly busy, but we'll find times anytime you'd like. Thank you again.
You bet.
Have a lovely evening.
You bet. You too. And we'll let Patrick go, and I'll share with the audience. I'm going to keep talking about him because I'm armed to the gills for this segment, because I was truly excited to have the chance to talk to Patrick. He recently retweeted this from climatediscussionnexus.com from September last year. Everybody knows the ice core record shows that CO2 controls the climate. That should be in quotes because it's facetious, because this is what I believe Patrick said about this article. Their paper was published in a technical journal called Environmetrics. This might be from the article, or it might be Patrick's comment on that article. Their paper was published in Environmetrics and written in language no one but their fellow math geeks would understand, probably saving them a lot of name calling for reporting what they concluded, which was stated in plain language that temperature changes precede CO2 changes. I know, so that he likes this. So the likely causality runs from temperature to CO2, not the other way around. Indeed, this is Patrick, there is no evidence in the data that changes in CO2 levels drive temperature, or at least if there is an effect, or if there is an effect, it would be too small to show up in their analysis. And from his download from, I think that was co2coalition.org, the positive impact of CO2 emissions on the survival of life on Earth, that came actually from Patrick's site, ecosense.me, from the executive summary. It is calculated that if the decline in CO2 levels were to continue at the same rate as it has for the past 140 million years, life on Earth would begin to die as soon as 2 million years from now, and would slowly perish almost entirely as carbon continued to be lost to the deep ocean sediments. This is a point Patrick made earlier. But here's another bullet point. The combustion of fossil fuels for energy to power human civilization has reversed the downward trend in CO2 and promises to bring it back to levels that are likely to foster a considerable increase in the growth rate and biomass of plants, including food crops and trees. Next point. Human emissions of CO2 have restored a balance to the global carbon cycle, thereby ensuring the long-term continuation of life on Earth. This extremely positive aspect of human CO2 emissions must be weighed against the unproven hypothesis that human CO2 emissions will cause a catastrophic warming of the climate in the coming years. The one-sided political treatment of CO2 as a pollutant that should be radically reduced must be corrected in light of the indisputable scientific evidence that it is essential to life on Earth. And the book that Patrick described, the other book he wrote, Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom, available at Amazon.com. Here's the description for that. Dr. Moore's description of his unique thesis as presented in this book, Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom, quoting Patrick. It dawned on me one day that most of the scare stories in the media today are based on things that are invisible, like CO2 and radiation, or things that are very remote, like polar bears and coral reefs. Thus, the average person can't observe and verify the truth of these claims for themselves. They must rely on activists, the media, politicians, and scientists, all of whom have a huge financial and/or political interest in the subject, for the truth. We have to rely on those kind of people for the truth. He went on to write, "This is my effort, after 50 years as a scientist and environmental activist, to expose the misinformation and outright lies used to scare us and our children about the future of the Earth. Direct observation is the very basis of science. Without verified observation, it is not possible to know the truth. That is the sharp focus of this book." Again, that was Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom. Elsewhere on his site, he wrote, "I left Greenpeace because I found myself, after 15 years in the leadership, the only director of six directors of Greenpeace International with any formal science education." He wrote, "I have an honors BSc in biology and forest biology, a PhD in ecology, during which I was the recipient of a Ford Foundation fellowship, an honorary doctorate of science from North Carolina State, the Einstein Society's Award for Nuclear Science and History," and Dr. Patrick Moore wrote, "and he has over 40 years experience," now it's 50 years experience, "in all aspects of the environmental movement." This was more than a synchronicity that I was introduced to Patrick and encouraged to invite him on today, because in the last couple of weeks, very, very specifically top of mind, I had given myself a homework assignment. I've really got to look at and study a lot more about climate change and global warming, so I know what's what. And then almost instantly, Patrick was referred to me, and I just enjoyed that conversation with him tremendously. And this is the transcript of an article by a Joseph Cotto from about 10 years ago, based on his conversation with Patrick. This is called How to Stop Worrying and Love Mother Nature. And Joseph Cotto asked Patrick, "Environmentalism is a concept with which most of us are familiar, yet tend to have our own definitions of. What does it mean to you?" And Patrick Moore said, "Yes, the semantics can be confusing. One approach is to just accept the word as a general term denoting concern for nature and the environment. It gets more complicated when you consider whether humans are a part of the environment or not." And this is the point I made before, where he said, "Environmentalism is an ism like capitalism and socialism. In that sense, it connotes an ideology or shared set of beliefs, not necessarily based on scientific proof or evidence. An environmentalist is therefore distinct from an ecologist, as ecology is a science." He continued, "If someone claims to be an environmentalist, I assume they care about nature and about our impact on it. But one must dig deep to find if they are misanthropic or accepting of humans as part of the environment. This is really a question of attitude rather than facts." And then Mr. Cotto asked Patrick, "One of the gravest concerns you have cited with the modern environmentalist movement is its increasingly ideological nature. Some might say that this, in fact, is a positive development. How would you beg to differ?" And Patrick Moore said, "Ideology is negative insofar as it tends to divide people into warring camps with no possible resolution. My late Greenpeace friend Bob Hunter suggested early on that in order for environmentalism to become a mass movement, it would have to be based on ideology, or as he called it, popular mythology, because, quote, not everybody can be a PhD ecologist, close quote." And Patrick said, "I have never accepted organized religion, and note all the evils perpetrated in the name of God is on our side. I do believe in just wars, such as the armed struggle to end apartheid, but that was not based on religion, but rather on human rights. For example, Patrick went on, it has become part of environmental ideology, as stated by Bill McKibben in the current Rolling Stone, this was back in 2012, that the fossil fuel industries are public enemy number one. Well, folks, I'm referring you to the work of Dr. Patrick Moore. He is the director of the CO2 Coalition, co2coalition.org, and he's got his own site called ecosense.me, and it certainly it behooves us to get up to speed, probably quickly, about these things, given all the threats to life support that he discussed, and that you can count on hearing at World Stage with Bruce DeTauris here at TNT Radio.